2 on Monday, the 7th of March. Present with us are Representative Phillips, myself, Representative Porter, Representative James, and Representative Cott. We will be taking up three bills today, a continuation on HB 334, 99-year penalty, third felony conviction, HB 439, Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, and HB 339, No Censorship, American History Documents. And I think we'll be taking up HB 339 second, if memory serves. We had just received an overview from the sponsor who was here, Representative Bundy, on this bill previously, and time ran out. Representative, would you like to give us a summary of the overview so we could have a basis to start with?
Well, if you need memory refreshed there, I don't want to rehash if what I've gone over. Let's just basically say that this requires a 99-year mandatory sentence for someone who's convicted of a Class A or unclassified felony after already having two previous convictions for previous felonies. There are some amendments that I have. I think you have in your packets. I talked to Representative Cott, and perhaps so that we'll.
I don't know why I don't have that.
You don't have the amendments?
No, I don't have any of it.
And rather than deal with the unamended bill, let's it would be my suggestion, if you concur, that we amend the so we have a judiciary CS, and then we'd be dealing with this.
Okay, we have online Ed McNally and Barbara Brink from. Ed McNally from the DA's office, Barbara Brink from the Public Defender's office, and Brant McGee from OPA. We also have Dean Guinelli in the audience here that can help us if we get bogged down. It may be of value to their testimony to go ahead and go through these amendments first so that they know what it is that they're testifying to. Could I ask if Ed, Barb, and Brant are online and can hear us?
This is Edward McNally. I'm online and can hear you very well. Thank you.
Is Brant with? Very good. If it's okay with you, we will proceed with the amendments so that you can have the benefit of having that information prior to your testimony.
And Mr. Chairman, you noted Mr. Guinelli here, and also have Mr. Luckett, who drafted the amendments. So I'd like to defer to their expertise, and might ask them to join me as we discuss the amendments.
We have the amendments in front of us. I'll share with Representative James. And you've got them?
I just have one for 339. I have a bunch for 334.
That's what we're discussing on 334.
Oh, I'm sorry.
334.
I have them, thanks.
Okay. For ease of identification, if we could call the First Amendment, which is J.1, I guess, Amendment Number 1.
J.1 through 4.
Jerry, welcome. Why don't you tell us for the record who you are, and we'll go through these amendments.
For the record, my name is Jerry Luckup. I'm legislative counsel for your Division of Legal Services. Amendment J.1 corrects a little problem that the Department of Law noticed in the draft. Currently, we provide that there are certain cases where 3 years ago, when the legislature adopted the 99-year mandatory prison term for certain first-degree murders, for example, murders of cops, torture murders, things like that, there was some concern that if that mandatory 99-year prison sentence provision could be read as to exclude the court imposing consecutive sentences for other crimes that were being tried at the same time or maybe imposed at the same time. And so the legislature 3 years ago put in the last sentence that you see in this amendment, saying that nothing in AS 1255-125A, which is the 99-year prison sentence term, limits the court's ability to impose consecutive sentences. All we're doing is expanding that provision to cover this situation where we're imposing 99-year mandatory sentences. It's a fairly technical sort of thing. It's, I don't believe, very controversial. It just clarifies and what the law is on the subject and basically prevents some litigation from occurring in the future as to whether or not these other sentences could be imposed consecutively or not.
Okay. I've got a feeling that I've got the wrong draft in front of me. What draft are we working on, though?
We're working from the CS blank that stated 226.94.
Okay. Well, this is page 2, line 7.
It doesn't
match up.
Let's see. Section 2. Line 7.
Page 2, well, following line 7.
Oh, I see.
We're inserting the rebuild
section.
Well, then it's line 8, isn't it? Not line 7.
Well, it's following line 7. We
following
start a new bill
7.
Section,
okay.
And then
it jumps
in front of all the others.
Okay, I got you. Well, then I'm okay.
Amendment J.2 is...
Let's see what Representative Cowan...
I'd like to move amendment number 1.
Okay. amendment number 1. Is there any discussion on amendment number 1? Seeing none, is there objection? Amendment number 1 is adopted. Jerry?
Amendment J.2 is a housekeeping measure. In an earlier draft of this bill, there was some concern that we might need to specify that we aren't interfering with the governor's pardon power. This language goes into a provision that says that these 99-year prison sentences that someone receives under this section may not otherwise be reduced. There was a concern at one point that we need to specify that we aren't interfering with the governor's pardon power, and that's what this provision says, 3320070. The governor's pardon power derives under the Constitution, and I see no reason why we need this section in there. We also have removed the sections where we were requiring the governor to notify the legislature. That was in an earlier draft of this bill. We were requiring the governor to notify the legislature whenever he might grant a pardon or a commutation of sentence for one of these people that have received a 99-year mandatory sentence. We've removed those provisions from the bill. I see no reason to keep this language in the bill. There's no reason why we need to say that. We haven't said that in other situations where the legislature has provided that sentences may not be reduced. And there's no reason to make a special occasion here and cause some ambiguity. So this, I believe, is a purely drafting style type amendment that is requested by our office that I see no substantive effect for.
I move amendment number 2.
Representative James has moved amendment number 2. Under discussion, I would just add that I agree, especially hearing the idea that we have not had this provision in other laws where we've set mandatory sentencing and extended terms. While this language may not serve a disservice to this statute, having it here might serve a disservice to other statutes where it is not included, having it pointed out here. So I would support amendment number 2. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Amendment number 2 is passed.
Amendment J.3 is an amendment that seeks to equalize the treatment of offenders that receive murderers that receive mandatory 99-year prison sentences under current law with habitual criminals that will receive a 99-year mandatory sentence of imprisonment under this law. Basically, it requires us... it does two things. The Amendment 1 takes away the good time that murderers who receive a mandatory 99-year sentence of imprisonment receive. Currently, someone that receives a mandatory 99-year term of imprisonment for murder is able to earn good time. Basically, one-third of their sentence can be cut off, so that a mandatory 99-year sentence of imprisonment for murder comes out to a 66-year sentence, basically.
Everybody in jail.
Under this draft, the people receiving the mandatory 99-year terms of imprisonment for habitual criminals, as a habitual criminal, are not eligible for good time. And so it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to allow good time for murderers that receive 99-year sentences and not in this case. And so this amendment takes away good time availability for those people sentenced to a mandatory term of imprisonment for 99 years for murder, just like we do for habitual criminals, from the date of this law would take effect. It also, with that sort of club, so to speak, we're also providing a little bit of mercy at the same time in that murderers that are sentenced to a mandatory term of 99 years currently receive have the ability to file for a motion for sentence reduction with the court after they serve half of their sentence and have their sentence reduced at that time. The court basically would take into account the circumstances. I believe one of the reasons the legislature did that 3 years ago for these murders was after this murderer has served 49 and a half years, he may be rather old, and the cost to the state start going up with a murder somewhere in the 60s or 70s, and the person may not be the same danger to society as they once were. Basically, we're adding that provision onto this bill that these habitual criminals that receive a mandatory 99-year sentence would be eligible to go to court just like the murderers that receive a mandatory 99-year sentence after they serve half their sentence, which would be 49 and a half years, and ask the court for a sentence reduction at that time. That this amendment amends, in our view, amends Alaska Rule of Criminal Procedure 35, so it will take a two-thirds vote to pass. And so the first part of the amendment deals with the amendments to the title, and under decisions of the Alaska Supreme Court, we have to flag those court rule changes in the title of the bill and provide a special section explaining what we're attempting to do. Mm-hmm. So that's what this bill does. And basically all we're doing is equalizing the procedure in this amendment as to good time between these two classes of offenders who receive mandatory 99-year sentences and their ability to seek a sentence reduction after they serve half their sentences.
Okay. President Kapp?
And I'd like to move amendment number 3.
Amendment number 3 has been moved. Discussion? Jerry Hunter, discussion. If we are taking away with one hand the lack of good time credits that would have accrued, but giving the ability for a review in half the sentences, that's in effect what exists now for the 99-year murder situation?
Well, not exactly. Mr. Chairman, under the current situation with murderers who, cop killers, that receive a mandatory 99-year sentence, they are eligible for good time currently.
Okay,
they are also eligible after they serve one half of their sentence without calculating good time. So that's 49 and a half years. They're eligible to ask the court for sentence reduction. The habitual criminal bill, HB 334, wants to take away good time mm-hmm. for these people to receive these mandatory 99-year sentences. And so as a
that's matter requiring of the court rule change.
Right. Okay. And so we're balancing out what the bill is attempting to do with current law dealing with the earning of good time for murderers that receive mandatory 99-year sentences and taking the benefit of current law that goes to murderers and being able to seek a sentence reduction, applying that to the bill draft.
Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, I need this clarified. If a person serves time and gets off time early for good time, they have to still serve 66 years or two-thirds of the sentence?
Under current law, dealing with those individuals that receive a mandatory 99-year sentence mm-hmm. for certain types of murder, they are eligible for good time. The good time amounts to one-third of their sentence. And basically, the way the Department of Corrections calculates that, they just take it right off the top. And so the person would basically be serving a term of imprisonment of 66 years, the way I understand it.
And why don't we do away with the halftime thing and just leave them all at 66 years? By that time, it will really have sunk in their heads that they have done something wrong.
They'll really be old.
Really old.
Buddy?
Well, I think part of that was to address one, a humanitarian, the other, a fiscal problem, and that somebody who is convicted under this when they are 30 years old. At 75, one, the expense to the state keeping them in prison goes up, and two, they physically probably aren't capable of being the danger to society that they were.
Some of the,
that's an assumption.
I guess to respond to your question, some of the people that I could see being convicted under this, which used to be the old habitual criminal, may want to be reviewed halfway through to see whether it would be appropriate to let them out. Others may want to be reviewed, but no way would I or anybody else in their right mind recommend that they mm-hmm. should get out, as opposed to good time, which is out.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct. The court, in considering that motion for sentence reduction, you know, could always decide not to grant it.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Or
okay.
could reduce the sentence by 20 years or something and still make the person serve an additional 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
the court does not have to immediately let the person out. It's not an all or nothing shot there. But the court has the authority under Rule 35, basically, to consider any reduction in sentence.
Further discussion on amendment, Representative Norland?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, as a matter of policy, when we basically eliminate good time, what kind of an effect that will have on the Department of Corrections? Will that make it more difficult to manage prisoners if they are not able to, if there's no incentive for them to be good? I mean, I assume that's the reason for good time. I'm not even sure, but maybe Diane or somebody can answer.
Diane Shanker from the Department of Corrections is here. Diane, why don't you come up while you're coming up? That actually is one of the reasons that I thought it was a good idea to put the possibility of the review halfway through the sentence, because there is some ray of hope out there. But
Mr. Chairman, if I might just interject that good time, as you pointed out, is automatic out. The review for sentence reduction reviews your performance while you've been in jail. So it still gives the carrot to behave yourself, but it isn't an automatic out.
Diane, for the record.
Hi, I'm Diane Shanker from Department of Corrections. And the department believes, having guessed that the average lifespan of an adult male is going to be 73 and a half years, and given the age that offenders are going to come in for these offenses, that a 66 or a 50-year term is not going to be a great motive for anyone to behave, particularly in and of itself, whether they're going to be reviewed with what is probably a fairly remote possibility of a sentence reduction, or whether they're going to have 33 years lopped off that they probably wouldn't have lived to serve anyway. It's our position that they're basically going to be in for life. And while that does create some management problems, as we do have people serving those kinds of sentences now, 300 and 400 year sentences, as long as we have something to hang over prisoners' head, we can manage the prisoner. When people see in our budget that we've got GED or work programs at Spring Creek where a lot of people are doing life sentences, sometimes they wonder why we would waste those kinds of resources, but because the person's never going to get out. But if you give the prisoner something to do that you can take away, sometimes you can get some much more cost-effective control over an inmate than just using brute force. And as long as we at least, we would really like to emphasize that with this kind of sentence, we probably need those programs more than ever. And that's not part of our fiscal note because it really isn't an issue in the bill, but that's how we try to control the good time as opposed to the sentence reduction. The department doesn't have a strong position that either one of them would be a particularly more motivation than the other.
Thank you. Further discussion? Is there objection to amendment number 3? Diane, thank you. If not, amendment number 3 is passed.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number 4, J.4, recognizes that the conspiracy bill was recently signed by Governor Hickel. Since the conspiracy bill was signed by Governor Hickel just recently, I can start including it in bills that in the drafting of bills now that we know that is going to take effect at some definite time in the future. This bill defines as a most serious felony offense for purposes of looking at the previous offenses that someone is convicted to determine whether or not they're a habitual criminal subject to sentencing under this law. We look at whether or not they committed various attempts or solicited various crimes, unclassified and Class E felonies, and a few sexual offenses, Class B sexual offenses. This expands out that attempt or solicitation, these inchoate crimes, as they are called, these inchoate forms of these main crimes, to include conspiracy, which is basically going along with what we just, you know, because the bill was the law, the conspiracy law was just passed in Alaska. It adds another inchoate crime and follows along with the intention of the bill to include all of those inchoate, incomplete crimes that are, inchoate is basically a term that deals with a crime that can be completed without the crime actually being, the ultimate crime actually being completed. And so this just makes conspiracy, puts it on the same level as attempt and solicitation in this bill.
I had that noted on my copy, as a matter of fact, ready to go. Is there anyone like to consider amendment number 4?
So moved.
Representative Catt moves amendment number 4. Is there further discussion? Is your objection? Amendment number four, adding, adding for Cliff, who just sat down again, conspiracy to the list of crimes that...
Are you going to have anybody out of prison?
No. And the most serious felonies.
Turn Island of Kodiak into a gulag.
Okay, seeing no objection, amendment number four is passed. We have completed, I believe, the amendments then that were under consideration. We'll go to the testimony and start with, we'll start with Brent McGee. Is he ready? Thank you, Brent. Representative Bundy has a question.
Well, just a comment I'd like to make. One, this bill does include latitude for prosecutorial discretion so that these inadvertent crimes that we're talking about, the example of vehicular homicide, wouldn't necessarily be tried under this statute. And as was pointed out, a third serious felony would be a 15-year minimum sentence. You take off a third for good time, and now we begin to see the revolving door.
Thank you, Representative Bundy. Next, Barb Brink.
I'll attempt to not to be repetitive of what Mr. McKee had to say, but I think it bears repeating.
Thank you, Barb. Next, we have Ed McNally.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think that the Department of Law is very grateful, and the Criminal Division is particularly grateful to the sponsor, who has worked closely with us in trying to hammer out a three-strikes bill that is unique to Alaska, that works with Alaska's not only its legislative statutes, but also with the practices in this state. I think that the sponsor has carefully crafted a bill that avoids the kinds of concerns that have been raised about President Clinton's proposal, that avoids the kinds of concerns that we saw on the front page of Alaska's newspapers, and in which a nonviolent offender in Washington State apparently is facing the three strikes bill as a kind of mechanical, almost mathematical machine that simply grinds up defendants who meet the right boxes on the charts. I would like principally to respond to some of the concerns raised by Brant McGee and by Barb Brink. Mr. McGee characterized this bill as a radical departure from previous legislative approach. I respectfully disagree with his characterization. I believe that characterization misunderstands the approach that the sponsor and others who support this legislation is taking. First of all, it's not a departure in the sense that the legislature very recently made a decision to pick out certain individual crimes, cop killing, torture murders, and actually a similar kind of crime, two-time murderers, to serve out mandatory, no parole, 99-year sentences. So I think that this is a natural extension of the progress the legislature has recently made in addressing just sentences for the crimes that Alaskans are rightfully most concerned about. We've heard some of the others who have testified characterize why presumptive sentencing came about. I know that there are participants in today's hearing who were practicing when presumptive sentencing came about or were part of the legislature. My understanding has been that, plainly put, many in the legislature and many in the citizenry were dismayed with the sentences that were being handed down by the courts. Not only the disparity issues that Ms. Brink raised, but also the simple fact that the sentences were not severe enough to address the issue of justice. I think perhaps a good example of this is one that's very much on people's minds in South Central Alaska, which is the Chico Rodriguez case. This is a man who was convicted of child sexual molestation, very elaborate, very staged, grooming techniques used. Ultimately, he was convicted of offenses against 11 Alaska children. He was sentenced initially to 133 years, then it was reduced to 83 years, then it was reduced 48 years. Most recently, it was reduced to 24 years. And what we have is a man who was convicted in 1983, where his victims believed he would be in jail essentially for the rest of their lives. And now they learned that he may be released on mandatory parole in as little as 4 years from now. And I had a haunting phone call from an adult man. It was an adult male voice calling me, speaking about the experiences of a child. He was one of Chico Rodriguez's victims, and he had thought this nightmare was behind him. And now it is back. That is, of course, an example of an 11-time loser. He would not have been subject to the three strikes legislation because he was convicted of all of those, in essence, at once. Mr. McGee gave a specific example of sort of a three-time manslaughter convictee, and I think that Representative Bundy has very correctly and accurately represented the idea, the whole reason that Representative Bundy has suggested prosecutorial discretion, which is something that the defense community often is in favor of. Ms. Brink spoke out against it in this case, but often is in favor of, is because it allows the prosecution to prevent the Washington State-type machine to simply mathematically grind up a defendant who on paper falls under three strikes, but clearly is not the kind of case that Representative Bundy or other sponsors of this legislation were contemplating. I'd also like to respond to Mr. McGee's sense that the focus of these hearings ought to be whether there is evidence of recidivism and whether people have reoffended after the release following these. And I think that the problem with that analysis and that challenge is that only goes to the issue of public safety. But it's clear from the sponsors' comments and from those of many others who support it that we're not just talking about public safety. The reason for this legislation is also for justice. And when I refer to justice in this context, I'm talking about the Cheney criterion of community condemnation. And we haven't taken a vote on three strikes in Alaska, but the nearest state is Washington State, and when they voted in a vote that really counted, not a public opinion poll, but in a referendum, 76% of the men and women who vote in Washington State believe that community condemnation means three strikes and you're out. So the suggestion that we should only be looking, Barb Brink talked about the premise that dangerous offenders are getting out of jail too soon. There's no indication from my many conversations with both sponsors and citizenry about this that their focus is on simply public safety. The primary focus appears, in fact, to be justice. To quickly respond to the final observations that Ms. Brink had made, she's concerned about the, rightly concerned about the legal work that needs to be done in any sentence that involves such high stakes. And on behalf of the prosecution, I would say simply we welcome that litigation. We already litigate aggressively and extensively sentences in capital type cases, in murder cases, and other serious cases where there's 99 years of exposure. All of those sentences are appealed already. And I guess the real point is sentencing litigation is pretty extensive as it is now. And the case I mentioned earlier, Chico Rodriguez, is probably a good example of that. He wasn't sentenced under three strikes, you're out. But his case went to the Alaska Court of Appeals no fewer than three times. We're just talking about the sentence, not the conviction. And it went to the Alaska Superior Court, I'm going to get this approximation, either three or four times. So that's something that's been litigation for now 11 years. And it's not as if we're not already doing that with important sentencing proceedings as it is. So finally, in terms of prosecutorial discretion, Ms. Brink suggested that this should not be a tool to reach resolution where perhaps the prosecution doesn't have sufficient evidence. On behalf of the state, I couldn't agree more. We are not looking or supporting this as a tool in order to allow us to browbeat out sentences in cases where the evidence doesn't merit a conviction. Our standard of proof is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Barb Brink is one of the state's great experts because she has frequently played the role of negotiating the bulk of the public defender's cases here in Anchorage. And in that capacity, Ms. Brink has faced the threat of the legislatively imposed presumptive sentencing scheme virtually every business day of her practice. And we in Alaska have a long body of experience now with presumptive sentencing, with not using presumptive sentencing to simply beat pleas out of citizens who on the evidence, shouldn't be pleading guilty to any crime. That concludes my representation on behalf of the Department of Law and Criminal Division, and I'm happy to respond to any questions that specific members may have. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. McNally. We have a question from Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McNally, the approach of which you speak, it seems to me, is a jam, slam, bam approach to filling up the correctional pipeline. And you've picked out a couple of almost hideous examples, it seems, but should we pass this legislation on the basis of one or two? Are they exceptional, unique examples? I'm not sure. My question is, it sounds like you're part of the task of getting people who are dangerous to society behind bars or away from people who don't want to be around people like that is laudatory. However, it seems to me that there are other parts to the puzzle here. One is, of course, what do you see the result of the budgets necessary to pass this kind of legislation? I mean, we know that we're already facing increased prison populations, and when you take away the flexibility or the discretion of the judge, or in this instance, the prosecutors, where would you be if, in fact, you were sitting in a different seat in the process? And secondly, could you give us the numbers that people keep saying that there simply is no evidence to indicate that the problem is as great as this bill would address?
Mr. Davidson and Mr. Chairman, I do not have the specific numbers. The numbers I've heard in conversations with members of the legislature, and I believe these come from Department of Corrections, but I cannot say with certainty the Department of Corrections told me this exactly. And perhaps the sponsor is able to clarify this, that under the law as drafted now, under the sponsor substitute, we're talking about perhaps 6 to 12 Alaskans a year who might fall under it. Is anyone in the room able to clarify whether that estimate is correct or has the Department of Corrections provided a different number?
Hold for just a second, Ed. Diane?
I don't don't know if the members have our fiscal note that's been submitted.
Yes.
We used a number of different methods to try to get at this, but if you can look on page 3 of the fiscal note, it's a 7-page fiscal note. Basically, we looked at the annual number of prisoners who were sentenced for these offenses currently, and you can see that in the second table on page 3. In this example, I'm only referring to the Class B felonies, which were in the original version of the bill, because during the span that a fiscal note measures is only 6 years, and Class A felonies and unclassified felonies are serving more time than that anyway. However, we took the number of cases that are sentenced per year, not the number of people incarcerated for these crimes here, but who are sentenced per year now, and it's explained earlier in the fiscal note how we arrived at assuming that 10% would have two or more of the most serious felony priors. So your third column whittles it down to 10 offenders a year there on just the Class B felonies. Mm-hmm. However, we also, on page 6 of the fiscal note, tried to get at the number of all felons that would be impacted by this, even though it will never be measured on the front page of the fiscal note, because with our department, as is the case in a lot of anti-crime legislation, we will not receive funding, but the effect is going to impact us 10, 15, and 20 years down the line without funding. And the table on page 6 is very complicated, but tries to measure that, and in fact, instead of trying to have a crystal ball and estimate total number of offenders every year for the next 46 years, we use a 46-year time cycle because that's the average lifespan expectancy once they've committed the crime. We think they'll live for 46 more years on the average. So using that 46-year span on page 7, extrapolating the number of offenses that occur times the increase in sentence over what their sentence is under current law and increasing it to their full lifetime, we estimate a total of, in the first version of the bill, 162,000 prisoner days, which would actually be 445 prisoners eventually. That's over the course of 46 years, but they'd get them. Now, we have not been able to recalculate everything on the new version, but a very rough calculation basically reduce that by half. However, I have not again recalculated anything on the amendments that were made today, whether that will impact it or not. But it's a very long-term effect, and we're also looking at maximum security beds, which are higher cost than average beds. So while our fiscal note may, if the B felons are removed, which I think they are now, you will see a zero on the first 6 years, mm-hmm. but we are absolutely aware that if you take But again, without the B felonies, it will be zero. The only other thing I could add is that depending upon the amount of with the addition of prosecutorial discretion, it makes it, even though the intent is probably to help reduce some of the costs, it does make it very difficult for our department to estimate the cost. And in fact, it can make the costs more immediate, because if the effect of the prosecutorial discretion is to use this as a tool in plea bargaining, then rather than waiting for 20-year sentences to turn into 45-year sentences, we may have a higher increase in less than Class A and unclassified felonies. In other words, when someone commits a most serious felony, if the prosecutorial discretion is used to bargain that down to a lower felony that doesn't fall under this sentencing scheme, then we may see an increase in those bargained down felonies in an immediate sense. In other words, they would have gone trial, but if you when plea bargaining occurs, what happens to our population is we might get more people with shorter lengths of time, and that makes it a more immediate impact, but it makes it, we have no way to predict that.
Okay.
Because even if anyone could predict it, policies change in the prosecutor's office, and we can't ever be assured of what would happen in the future as far as how that
let me suggest one other one that might at a minimum offset that, if not make some more. If you had somebody who was sentenced to the 46 rather than the 20, considering the 85% recidivism rate of people at that level of criminal experience, you probably saved yourself some that you were projecting anyway, because he's still there.
Correct. Also, if the again, at that higher age group, all of our numbers use our standard cost per day, which means that the overhead for medical cost is just the average medical. But right now, less than 1% of our prison population is over the age of 65, and obviously in a very long time, but in an inevitable long period of time, a much larger percent will be over that age. Also, some experience from other states suggests that if it's up to the inmate to ask for the sentence reduction, a person who's been institutionalized for 30 or 40 years and who is experiencing some medical problems may or may not want to be asking for that sentence reduction, because the person may or may not feel like, whether it's correct perception or not, that they'll receive the kind of institutionalized care that they may need at that point. So that's another concern.
Representative James?
Yeah, this is just a question. I may have been living in a vacuum or something, but I'm surprised at the small number of people that would fall under this category. I thought there would be more than that, and I'm amazed. And I suppose that every time that you have someone doing a real serious crime out there and you put them away, then you know they're not going to do that again, so there's going to be maybe mm-hmm. some reduction in the crime that happens out there. But I really am amazed that the number is so small, the people that fall into this category.
The chair?
Ms. Schenker, yes.
We asked for help from the Judicial Council, and we actually did a file review ourselves, and actually we were a little surprised. There's a much, much higher number of repeat felons, but when you isolate it down to the specific violent felonies that the sponsor included in the bill, it really does go down to quite low.
Representative James?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One more question then. Is there any, from just my perception of being out there in the general public and what you hear and what you read in the paper and so forth, and my perception would there be more of these people, is it possible that the reason that there isn't any more of them is because some of them have already plea bargained down, and so they're being incarcerated for a lesser crime than they really were guilty of?
Mr. Chair, it's entirely possible. Again, any effect of plea bargaining is unmeasurable by our department, because there's no way to get that information from any data that's available to us without individual file reviews that we would have to get from the Department of Law. So we have no way of knowing that. Sorry.
Representative Norton?
Thank you. I guess I agree with Representative James that maybe there aren't that many people that this applies to, that maybe that there's this public perception that is somewhat mistaken, that people, after they committed a couple serious felonies, can commit a third and still not serve significant time, and that maybe this bill is attempting to solve a problem that doesn't really exist. But I have a question for, or actually a request for Diane and the Department of Corrections. I'd be curious to see what the nature of the crimes have been of the people who this would apply to. I mean, what was the first, second, and third felony that they committed? And to, you know, in other words, to take real-life examples as opposed to sensational examples that Mr. McNally used that actually wouldn't even apply under this bill.
Those are pretty real-life, though. You can't separate real life.
Okay.
Now let's ask the question.
That was an improper use of terms, and not real life examples, but more average examples, though, let me put it that way, of the kinds of series of crimes of which somebody would come in under this. And my general concern is that I'm very sympathetic to the public's concern that there perhaps are people who have committed a third felony are still out there continuing to commit those crimes, and I'm very concerned that the public safety is being compromised in those situations. You know, it's not hard to imagine a certain series of crimes here that in which the third commission, you would not want to have that person put away for 99 years. When I look at manslaughter and assault and escape, there might be circumstances in those particular situations in which you would not want to have somebody have a 99-year sentence imposed on them. So, you know, Mr. McNally uses an extreme example. I'd like to come up with some examples with maybe, where we wouldn't want to impose a 99-year sentence.
Diane, can you respond to that now? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I can't respond completely. I will say that one of the problems we had in compiling this data, and one of the caveats I should make, is that confusion as to concurrent convictions makes this data a little more inaccurate. If the first two felonies could be taken from one event, and then the third has to be after that conviction as a later felony, it is not possible for us
the way that we get our data off our computer to really isolate those double convictions, and so we may not have picked some of those up. In fact, we probably did not, and I'm not sure that we will be able to. And in answer to your question, the only way that we can answer your question is to actually pull individual files and read them, and we just don't have the staff resources to do that. We did 10 files, which is a very small, unscientific sample for this, because we and fortunately, when we did the 10 individual files, it backed up what we kind of guessed from the data, but
this,
we don't have
this
it.
This requires that two or more convictions out of the same event would not be considered. Is that not correct? That's what I thought.
And any of the three strikes?
That's right.
Okay. And the other point that we did notice is that a lot of people, one of the reasons the number might be smaller than some people imagine is that since the bill addresses very serious felonies in the first place, they got long sentences, then they did have a period of mandatory supervision, the SGT good time that we talked about, plus possibly any probation. And so when those people reoffend, it's much likelier that they are back in on a probation parole violation, which does not, at least in our analysis, count as one of the three subsequent strikes, even though, in fact, it's not uncommon for a parole violation to be another felony, but it's easier to violate someone's parole than to retry them for that felony. So they may have already been returned for a significant period of time. You could have got years and years of probation violations, and that could still only be their second. So I think what we found with the few files we were able to review was that sex offenders and drug crimes were the likelier to be repeated. You didn't very often get somebody doing two different murders or certainly manslaughters in different occasions, and that...
Well, I can think of one or two.
It can happen, but it's so rare, whereas the examples that we did find did involve sex offenses or drug crimes, and that most of the felons we found had thefts and misdemeanors and other crimes are not addressed in the bill on their priors. But
okay. Are there any other questions of Diane? You're done, Diane. Thank you very much. I have no one else scheduled to testify. What is the wish of the committee? Representative Bundy?
Just a brief wrap-up. you will be getting a more accurate fiscal note now with these changes. There's been some discussion about there's only 5 to 10 people a year, but these 5 to 10 people, for those of us who've been to these town meetings, commit an amazing amount of mayhem and make victims and out of society, trap people in their fear, even if they're not the actual victims. They're victims of a fearful society. We've talked about money and what it costs. I mean, what will it cost our kids if they are indeed the victims of these admittedly minority, small group of people who are such fearful repeat offenders? I don't have any sociological data. I just have anecdotal stories that we've all heard at these various crime meetings. And the general public is very fearful of this small group of people, and they're asking for some action, and I certainly hope you give it to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. What is the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Representative Norland?
Unfortunately, I was not here for the first hearing on this bill, and I'm a little torn on it right now. I mean, I do support it in some ways, and in other ways, I feel like perhaps the net we're casting here is a little bit too broad, particularly in the inclusion of Class A felonies. I would like to have a little bit more time just to feel more comfortable about the kinds of crimes here we're including. And so I would hope that we don't pass this out today.
Representative Cott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we've heard quite a bit of testimony, and I, like the sponsor at many of these crime summits, have heard anecdotally that there are a number of problems out there, and really we are dealing with a very small group of individuals, and I don't think the fiscal ramifications are going to be as such that we won't be able to address it fiscally. So I would be in favor of moving this bill. I don't think there are any constitutional consequences that we haven't already addressed, and therefore I would move that we move the bill out of committee.
Representative Davidson, then Representative James.
Mr. Chairman, anecdotal basis for public policy may be fine in some respects, but when we're talking about fear, and I can understand people's fear, but you know, I think we need to examine this this piece of legislation a little more carefully and try to understand what what it is about the fear that these individuals are generating, and in fact, does this address the fears of people? I hate to think that with the people who are working most closely with these types of individuals who say the problem is certainly not as great as we may think, I don't want to be rushed into a public policy like this because I don't think it's good public policy then. And so I would be in favor of holding off a little bit longer until we got, in fact, past the anecdotal basis for passing this legislation on to the next committee and try to come up with a more realistic fiscal note, as well as the facts that would address us or address the problem that we face a little more accurately.
Representative James?
Yeah, I will vote to move this out of committee today, but I would like to share that some concerns that I have about the bill, and I have plenty of time to think about that between now and the time it gets on the floor. I guess one of the things that is a little frightening to me is when you put such a large penalty out there, that there will be more bargaining down and more people will be taking having a lesser charge just to be able to not have to go to trial. A lot of plea bargaining, I'm concerned about that. I think that it does meet the needs of what the people are asking for, because the people are very concerned about crime, and I know from my own standpoint that I see that it's the people that repeat crimes that do it, and I'm just amazed that there were so few in the statistics, but it could be that the statistics are not good because of the plea bargaining. I suspect that the things that we read about in the paper may not correlate to what the terms of penalty that are given. So I'm a little bit concerned about that. The fact that it's like 40-some years is the average length of stay in prison to give up a penalty that they're not even equal, can't even ask for parole until after that normal average lifespan has gone by, seems to be another thing that maybe we're going to be spending a lot of money to incarcerate someone that for any number of good reasons might have been able to have gotten released, maybe by a complete change of heart or some other kind of problems that or things that could have happened to them. So I have a little problem with the bill, but I'm going to vote to move it out because I think we've probably done everything to it that we can do at this point in time without including emotionalism.
Without including what?
Emotionalism. Oh. Well, I guess, in speaking to the bill, I'm going to vote to move it out also. I'm rather surprised that there hasn't been testimony or points made regarding the other side of this bill that I see it, that I have seen work when we had habitual criminal, and that is the ability to use this severe penalty as a deterrent for younger offenders who, for whatever reason, have had one or two crimes and can be taken aside and read the statute and say, do you know how close you are to going away for life? I have seen people redirect their life from just that realization. Secondly, I've seen people redirect their location back to whence they came when they found out that statute was on the books in Alaska. If for no other reason, I'm going to support the bill, but I also like the fact that it has been mitigated, I guess, to the extent that there is prosecutorial discretion on when to apply it, and something else that wasn't really commented on, but the progressive crimes have to be progressively more severe. You can't go backwards and then back into a 99-year sentence. So with that in mind, if there isn't any, Representative Davidson?
I'd just like to add that, you know, if we continue to give people who have to make the final decisions on these individuals fewer options, less flexibility, less discretion, and we're going to give them fewer resources with which to do the job. I mean, so often we've seen the result of putting something in a pipeline here, and in a few years we lo and behold, get to see the result of our actions. And I still have that concern. It just seems to me that we could get maybe some more input from the judicial system. I would like to hear some more from those people on the front line, like yourself, as you used to be, as well as the public defenders who have been down into the nitty-gritty of this problem. I mean, I just have this feeling that we can do better with this piece of legislation. And so I would urge us to examine it a little more thoroughly and hear the people out who have the most experience in dealing with these kinds of problems, and then see if we can't make some changes that would more realistically address the problem.
What is the wish of the committee?
I think I have a motion.
I've already moved to move it out.
We have a motion to move out? No, we haven't, but we do now.
Oh, I thought we did.
Nope. Is there further discussion? Is there objection?
Objection.
Objection. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Phillips?
Yes.
Not today.
Davidson?
No.
Cott?
Yes.
Yes. Porter?
Yes. We have moved 334.
Mr. Chairman?
With amendments. And a fiscal note to be provided as soon as Diane can get at it.
I might report that one of the first pieces of news I heard on the radio this morning was one of the other states that was the governor was in the process of signing or doing something to sign on this three strikes you're out bill.
He was right.
About when another state was adopting this.
He's about to. Okay. Next we have HB 339, titled No Censorship American History Document. We have two people to testify, but we also have the bill sponsor, Representative Cott, here, Representative, would you like to
physically and mentally? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, you have a copy of the sponsor statement. I'll just cover a couple of the highlights. The proposed bill relating to the use of historical documents in public schools is really what I would call enabling legislation. It is best described as an academic freedom measure, as it clarifies original source documents of American history that can and should be used to teach our children about American history in our schools, regardless of content, even though in many times the content may be explicitly religious. And basically all this is an option to allow teachers that are teaching history to use the original source documents to teach our students about their heritage. Whether we like it or not, the early 1700s and 1800s found that there are religious ideas embedded in many of the historical documents. Some of those historical documents include the Washington's Farewell Address and the Mayflower Compact. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that we support this measure and allow those teachers that desire to use the historical documents, give them that ability to, in fact, use it. I'll entertain any questions.
Okay, we've got three people to testify. Do you want to go through those before
yeah,
we get
fine.
Into questions? The first person that I have listed is Sheila Peterson of the Department of Education. Sheila, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sheila Peterson, and I'm Special Assistant to Commissioner Cuffey with the Department of Education. The Department of Education certainly is committed to academic freedom and is opposed to any effort at censorship. We support the use of the free use of historical documents in public schools. In fact, it appears currently that that is the case. No one has come to the department, expressed a concern that they have been denied or restricted in use of historical documents. As House Bill 339 is currently written, however, the department does have some concerns, and I'd like to just briefly discuss those with you today. On page 2, line 9, on paragraph C, it states that the teacher or the administrator cannot be disciplined for using a historical document. In a way, this appears to be allowing a blanket immunity that inappropriate use of a document or any teaching material should be open to disciplined or other appropriate actions. A similar concern is on page 2, line 6, which says that the use of historical document does not constitute the avocation of a partisan, sectarian, denominational doctrine. Possibly certain use of a historical document, if it's used inappropriately, may be advocating a denominational doctrine. Also on page 2, line 4, states that a historical document may not be altered to remove the religious or secular references. possibly this will in fact restrict the use of historical documents if it means that the document cannot be altered or abbreviated in any fashion. A fifth grade teacher may wish to use a document that they would like to abbreviate to allow that their student to understand what is being said. But because this language says that they may not remove any religious or secular reference, it may in fact have just the opposite effect of what we really would like to see. We would like to see the use of historical documents used freely within our public schools. To reassure teachers that there is no concern, possibly the committee would like to consider a cleaner and simpler approach to this problem, if there in fact is a problem. Section 1403090 currently states that partisan and sectarian or denominational doctrines may not be advocated in a public school, and if they are, that the school may not receive public money. Possibly just amending that sentence to say something to the fact that this section does not prohibit the use or the appropriate use of historical documents with religious references. Maybe this amendment, a simple approach, a cleaner approach, with taking away the possible blanket immunity that is currently in House Bill 339. So I guess the Department of Education would like to have you consider possibly changing the bill and just taking a simple and cleaner approach to this problem if, in fact, you determine there is a problem.
Thank you. Are there any questions? President Norman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, Sheila, have you seen the CS that we're considering today?
No, I have not.
I think this might be a simpler and cleaner approach that you're referring to. Maybe you could take a look at it before we get down here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nordland, the Department of Education would appreciate this committee substitute, or we do agree with it.
Thank you very much, Sheila. Representative Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, in the Judiciary Committee substitutes, it states that nothing prohibits use of historical documents that contain religious references. And I wonder if that is how that relates to the original bill, which says the avocation of partisan, sectarian, or denominational doctrine.
Well, as you see, at the beginning of this section already does that.
Okay,
next we have from the Department of Law, Jan Levy. I had a 50-50 chance with that name. I'll find out if I was right or not. Jan, I pronounced it right. Very good. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Jan Levy from the Department of Law, I'm Assistant Attorney General, and was asked by the staff of this committee to comment on HB 339. The department didn't see that there, in current law, would be any legal impediment at the present time to use historical documents with religious references. So at the outset, that's the opinion of the department. And if there's concern from districts or teachers, I think the clarification that Sheila was describing and that apparently is represented on, maybe I could take a look on a substitute here would do the job. And at a glance at this, I don't think the department would have any legal concerns at all about this amendment. It had a couple of concerns about 339 as we looked at it that really reiterate what Sheila had to say. Specifically in the statement made in B on page 2, is actually kind of a legal conclusion that a court might not even necessarily agree with. And so, as Sheila had mentioned, there certainly could be use of a document that contained religious references that could, if used incorrectly, be advocating some partisan or sectarian or denominational doctrine. And also the same concern regarding the rather sweeping statement in C that there could be no discipline for any use of a document. And I think those are really the main issues that were of concern to the Department of Law.
Representative Davidson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Ms. Levy, basically, it sounds to me what you've said is that this legislation is not necessary. Is that correct?
The department didn't see that there was a need for it, although we're not aware of concerns being raised.
So why are we in this exercise?
Do you wish me to respond to that? to find out whether we have any concerns expressed or not.
Okay.
Representative James?
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask a legal question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The concern that you just stated about the public school teacher administrator who uses a historical document may not be disciplined or otherwise acted against for using the document. And didn't you say, and I would agree with you, that it's not necessarily the using the document, it is how it is used and what kind of a advocacy might be given from the document. So if that were the thing, which it does say that they can't advocate anything, if they used a historical document and they advocated something from that document, wouldn't the charge to that teacher then be the advocacy more than it would be the using the document? I don't see that using the document by itself here would be a problem that would encourage them to do it incorrectly.
I don't think use of the document does either. I would agree with you. But B seems to say that use of a historical document does not constitute advocacy or advocation. And so it seems to encompass any use.
That's the big loophole.
Well, and I understand that. And I would agree that that is a loophole and would not necessarily constitute,
yes.
If we have that in there. I don't have, do we, on this substitute doesn't have a page two, is that correct?
That's correct.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to respond to Representative Davidson's concern. Is many times that if you don't have protection of something within the law, people assume that it's not there. And historically, historical documents with religious input are not used for that reason, because they're not sure they can, because it doesn't say they can or can't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Davidson?
I was just, here we have an expert on the law, and my feeling was that, you know, we're constantly being charged with putting on the books unnecessary laws, and so I just didn't want this to be an example of that.
Unless there's some other issues that were meant to be addressed by this bill that I'm not aware of, the amendment that was suggested to 1403090, while one could argue it's not necessary, it's also not a... It certainly would remove the question as to whether or not that use is permitted. Mm-hmm. It would resolve that.
Okay, Jan, thank you very much. The last person I have scheduled or written in is Vernon Marshall. With NEA.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Vernon Marshall. I'm executive director of NEA Alaska, and I did not receive a copy of the CS till about 2 seconds ago. But I would like to comment. We have spent some time both in the HES committee and since that meeting analyzing the bill, HB 339. And some of the points that we're concerned about were raised by the department and the Department of Law. Our first question is the bill really needed? Has anyone said that the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the State of Alaska, or the Pledge of Allegiance cannot be used in schools? House Bill 339 would not require the use of any historical document, but would be permissive. Therefore, is the bill really necessary? We raised that question. Second, House Bill 339 states that any historical document may be used in whole or in part, but may not be altered to remove religious or secular references when such references are part of the document's text. The bill addresses references only when they are part of the text of a historical document. Presumably, every part of a document is either religious or it's secular, one or the other. As HB 339 would appear to prohibit the use of a document if the administrator or the instructor alters or allows alteration of the document to remove religious or secular references. Another point that we noted, too, is that as a practical matter, the effect on textbook use and purchases could be devastating. a teacher could not assign part of the Emancipation Proclamation or the Gettysburg Address or the Declaration of Independence for discussion or memorization. A court decision, such as the Dred Scott decision or Brown versus the Board of Education, could not be studied at any level unless the entire decision, without abridgment, were used in the curriculum. Even in law school, casebooks abridged court decisions for pedagogical purposes are allowed to be taught. Surely abridgments are pedagogically appropriate at the elementary and secondary school levels. Fourth, assuming such restrictions on educators and programs were desirable, there is also another matter that's very practical and very real. We're not like California or Texas or New York. We're a relatively small market as far as textbooks are concerned. And if we demanded that textbook publishers revise their products to include the unabridged text of historical documents, again, this could be very restrictive on Alaska's public schools. Fifth, the goal is probably to encourage the use of historical documents, including religious references. But HB 339, if enacted, could be counterproductive. By restricting educators and by requiring that any historical documents that are used be used in their unaltered or unabridged state, HB 339 would discourage, not encourage, the use of documents in curriculum. I think the department made reference to that. A sixth point, have educators deleted these references from curricula? We have no information to indicate that any religious or secular material has been deleted from curricula. Has anyone seriously proposed, I know that in the Pledge of Allegiance, I believe that's guaranteed under the U.S. Code. I don't know of anyone that has even proposed amending the U.S. Code to remove God from the Pledge of Allegiance. A seventh point is the statement that a public teacher who uses a historical document may not be disciplined or otherwise acted against for using the document. If enacted into law, this could lead to an unintended result. Suppose a teacher were to use the Declaration of Independence in an algebra class for no proper purpose in this setting, or in that particular math setting. Does HB 338 or 339, mean that an algebra teacher could ignore the duty to teach that subject and avoid discipline so long as she talks about or he talks about historical documents? Eighth, in every state or federal court decision and all other documents published by a state or the federal government, are these particular documents worthy of treatment as historical documents? Because on page 2, on line 14, we include as historical documents state or federal enactments. On line 16, we include state or federal court decisions. And on line 17, we include documents published by the state and federal government. There are thousands or possibly millions of documents which the legislature and the U.S. Congress, if it enacts HB 339, would be elevated to a very sanctified level, authorizing the use of the materials by teachers and administrators with impunity, even if they were not suitable for the grade level and subject matter, as long as they're used without alteration or abridgment. Again, I can only refer to a lot of court cases that are referred to on line 16. Many court cases include grisly matter that I don't know that a teacher would necessarily want to teach or use that entire document in a classroom when they could probably use or most likely use an abridged form of that decision. A ninth point is that we feel that educators ought to decide relative to the proper use of a historical document. And again, the educator should be required to read the material, develop a lesson plan, and apply that document relative to that lesson plan and that course of instruction. Again, if the intent of the bill is to prohibit the alteration of a document by the omission of any reference, whether religious or secular, we are probably making an effort here, I would assume, to be even-handed. We looked at some Supreme Court enactments, and the most recent is the court decisions out of the state of Louisiana, where they did pass legislation to require even-handed treatment relative to creation science and evolution. And again, that particular provision was struck down. In this particular case, in an effort to be even-handed, we could be opening our schools up to possible litigation should a parent or group of parents attempt to challenge a form of teaching that would be allowed under this particular bill, or use of documents that would be allowed under this particular bill. We oppose the legislation. We would encourage the committee to also oppose the legislation, and would be glad to respond to any questions if you have them.
Representative Norlin?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bernard, I'm just wondering if you had a chance to look at that CS that's on our desk. And
well, again, I guess the underlined sentence is the yes. Addition. On the surface, I share the department's concern. I think it's much better than what's included in the House bill. Again, though, we feel if there's not a problem, and we have not been made aware of any problem relative to an administrator and or teacher who has been prohibited from using religious references, whether they be in the Constitution of our country, the state of Alaska, the Pledge of Allegiance, whatever, we just don't think it's needed. But again, we'd be more than happy if someone can indicate to us where there's a problem, and we'd be glad to take a look at it.
Representative Dorland and Representative Phillips. Just,
as far as you know, in classrooms, if, let's say, if you have a high school history class on religions, is it okay for the teachers to refer to the Bible and,
yes,
and make reference to the Quran or any other?
In both history and literature. It's done. And I noticed in the sponsor's materials, in fact, there's a court decision that has protected that particular use of religious references so long as we're not into a position of actually, in a sense, advocating a particular faith, whether it be advocated through the Quran or the Bible or whatever. I mean, that is pretty much prohibited and protected by the U.S. Constitution.
Representative Phillips?
I would just like to, at some point in time, for the sponsor to share some of his concerns as far as the necessity for something like this.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
I have no one else scheduled to testify. Is there anyone else in the room that wishes to present testimony on this bill? Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, I might ask the bill drafter and my staff that's been working this to maybe address some of the concerns constitutionally, but while they're coming up.
Mike, come on up. Mike Ford, and
I just wanted to bring up, while we're waiting on them, Representative Phillips, saying this is not an idea that was just run out of thin air. During the interim period, a couple of teachers asked me about this, and they were concerned that the language in the statute of advocating religious teachings basically prevented them from using historical documents in teaching history that contained religious activities. And I think there's two letters of support from a school board member as well as a former teacher, or I don't know, maybe he's currently a teacher, that also suggests there is potentially a problem and that this should be resolved. And certainly I think the bill does that. I don't believe that we're going to demand textbooks, authors, to provide the full document if they so deem not to provide it. And I certainly don't believe that we are, in fact, giving teachers, administrators, the option of using part of a document, either they can use the whole thing or part of it based on their own discretion. We're not telling them that here's a court case, you have to present the entire court case. You, as a teacher, administrator, based on your discretion, will select what portions of that is more appropriate. I mean, if there's language in there that is not appropriate for teaching seventh graders, I would submit that the teacher would not use it.
Anyone have any specific questions of Mike on the bill? Mike, any responses to criticism?
Mr. Chairman, I really don't have anything to add. I think the concerns of the Department of Law and the Department of Education, I don't know that I would quite go as far as they go in thinking that there is going to be a tremendous backlash of our teachers exploding with rampant advocacy of some strange sectarian or religious belief. Certainly the department already has broad authority to control public schools, and they already have curriculum guidelines. As I would look at this, it's simply an effort to achieve a neutrality level. If you have a document that qualifies as a historical document, then you can use that. And I understand their concerns that some of the provisions may, in fact, create a broader exception than you'd like to. You could tighten that up if that was your concern. As far as not being disciplined because they used the document, it's simply because we already have a provision of law saying you cannot have a religious, sectarian, a partisan sectarian or denominational doctrine. That provision is already in our law, so we have to add a provision to this bill which deals with that issue. And that's simply to say that using a historical document doesn't constitute that. So in an effort to get around that prohibition, we've added that provision to this bill. I don't think it was intended to allow for some blanket exemption for advocacy of, like I said, some...
Mike, could I ask, I see it in some of the documents except the bill, it says American history documents, but in the bill itself it just says historical documents, which obviously is a much broader scope than American history. Is there some reason why we can't use American history?
No, there's been some conversation about the definition of historical document. I think you should note that the way the definition is crafted, it simply says it includes these documents. And, of course, under our law, that means includes but not limited to. Mm-hmm. So it certainly would include American historical documents, maybe a lot of other things that is not in here. So I don't think the definition is intended to limit us. It's intended to just list things that are definitely included.